Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to the show. Today on the show, I've got one of the original crew of the SNL gang that started SNL, and that's Garrett Morris. And this is a pretty astounding interview, I would say. And I was excited to talk to Garrett. So that's happening today. Also, many of you know, obviously, that the other day, on Monday, when I did the plug for David Bowie's new record, Black Star, that I had not heard the news that the amazing David Bowie was no longer with us. And I taped it the night before, and I woke up to this horrible news. But I remember when I was reading the copy, I had this, you know, we were doing an ad for the album, and I was profoundly excited that David Bowie had the new record out, because not unlike many of you, I have to attribute David Bowie with really being responsible for a lot of my creative confidence. A lot of the way that, you know, I realized that you could really do whatever you wanted to do, and you could really be, you know, whoever you wanted to be. And also that, you know, some of his music, most of it was transcendent and never hackneyed or never like anything else. And I was sad when I heard that he had passed away. I guess I wasn't devastated because, you know, people pass away. I'm going to pass away. We're all going to pass away. And I thought he had left an amazing, amazing, you know, almost eternal bunch of work that, you know, and I look at it, I look at the records. And I mean, I think the first time that I ever, you know, came in contact with his work was, I was 15, I was at camp, and some guy had that Greatest Hits Volume 1 with Space Oddity and Changes and some other stuff. Maybe it was Changes. When I was in seventh grade, Changes came out. Fame, no, it was Fame. And I'd heard that, you know, maybe John Lennon had sang on the background, but I think it was that one. I think it was Fame, and I think it was Fame, Fame, Fame. I think it was that thing that sort of said, like, who is this guy? And then later, you know, I got the Changes One album because that kid at camp had it. And then even later than that, you know, years later in high school, Steve, the guy at the record store next door, started turning me on to, you know, the deeper cuts of Bowie and making me understand why, you know, Bowie was a genius, a true fucking genius. And also, you know, his approach or deconstruction or embracing of even extraterrestrial sexuality on some level, you know, it was freeing. David Bowie provided those of us who were sensitive and creative the freedom to know that it was okay. Whatever the hell you were going to do was okay. And if you felt heavy-hearted about it, you could just put on a fucking David Bowie song and be elated and transcend the commonplace garbage that culture provides for us. He was unto himself. He was like another fucking planet. And it was always consistent. But I know that when I heard he died, that the first thing I listened to was Station to Station twice. Station to Station twice. And then I listened to the song Heroes once. And then for some reason, I put on Lodger. I just wanted to hear Lodger. It was a little more fun. And so I listened to Lodger. And that's sort of you know, what I did with that day. I think one of the hardest things about your heroes dying is that your heroes die. And I don't know about you. I may think about death in the abstract. And I may sometimes think I'm dying. But to really process mortality is fucking terrifying to me. And I want it to be less terrifying. I want to accept it. I want to know it. I want to feel the humility of it and act accordingly in relation to that without the fear. And I think when David Bowie does something like, you know, have the fortitude and the creative will and the grace to work when he knows he's dying, to leave something, a testament of that process, and a sort of timeless gift to those people who loved him and to people who don't know of him. That's an amazing humility and commitment and acceptance. But I always have David Bowie. I can go into my house right now and play Heroes 10 times in a row if I want. And I've done that. You know, back in the 80s, for some reason, the song Heroes, still to this day, when he hits that high note, you know, it consistently just, it takes me to another place, into something, you know, almost dark and victorious. And it's so satisfying. You know, then you go to Iggy Pop, you go The Idiot, and then you go, you know, before that you go to Lou Reed, you go to Transformer, and then, you know, how excited, like to this day, I'm still excited when, you know, Satellite of Love comes on Transformer, and you can hear David Bowie singing in the back, and if I'm with somebody, I'll always say, you ready? Just listen, oh, oh, you know, in like that moment where you just, you know, it's Bowie, And if someone you're sitting with doesn't know the song very well, you're like, listen, 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 listen. And when David Bowie hits that high note in the background of Satellite of Love, you're like, that's fucking Bowie. Oh, you build such a relationship with the work of these people. And the good news is that we will always have that. And the sad news is that, you know, his generation of artists, you know, are getting older. You know, Lou was a pretty big hit, but then you start to realize, and sadly, you know, David Bowie was not old, but he knew it was coming, and he gave us Black Star, and he gave us everything that he gave us. And for those of us who love him, it's all there, man. It will always be there, and you can share it, pass it on down, or just sit with it. We're going to miss you, David Bowie. I am. You're so fucking great. So what else? Oh, geniuses. Geniuses. I'm not calling you all geniuses. But, you know, if you want, it's okay. You can call yourself geniuses if you want. You can call other people geniuses. But, you know, there's only a few geniuses. And I know that some of you were listening the other day. Before Charlie Kaufman, those of you who hung in for the opening ramble, and I told a story about my dad's cousin Brent, the genius. Now, I don't keep in touch with that side of the family, and it's my father's first cousin, so I don't know really what all happens, but because of the beautiful advent of technology, you know, people can get in touch. People can get in touch, and I told that story, and I got an email through my website email. Brent Maron, the genius chef, is the subject line. Hi, Mark. We met once at my grandparents' 50th or 60th anniversary. Eli was my grandfather, and Bookie Marin was my grandmother. Now, I knew Eli and Bookie. They were, you know, they were in Jersey. They were, I loved Uncle Eli. I knew Uncle Eli. He came to my bar mitzvah. He was my dad's uncle. He was my grandpa's brother. I knew Eli and Bookie very well. I have very good memories of them. But I met them when their kids were almost grown, obviously. But anyways, he goes, I listened to your most recent podcast this morning. It brought such a huge smile to my face to hear a story about my father. Not sure if you know, but he passed away in 2011. He really was a very smart man, and I feel fortunate to have had him in my life. Thank you for sharing your experiences. My mother listened as well after knowing there was a girlfriend mentioned. That was her. She asked if I could let you know that, quote, she did not smoke pot that night, unquote. Come over for eggs anytime. My dad trained me as a chef. Jess Marin. Because a few of you were like, what happened to Brent the genius? Well, sadly, Brent passed away, but his son Jess reached out to me, and that was a nice way to open the email box. All right, so this brings us to Garrett Morris. Garrett Morris gets sometimes does not get the recognition he deserves. He was obviously, or maybe not, if you don't know, the first African-American performer on SNL, on the original SNL. He'll tell that story among many other stories. He's a character. He's lived through some shit. He's got a great spirit. And it was great fun to talk to him. I learned a lot of things about him and about SNL and about you know, just the struggle that is the creative life. So let's go now to my conversation with Garrett Morris.
Yeah, let me call somebody a hot date and tell them we won't make it tonight.
What do you mean? You got time? What you be?
I'll have to see how later on. She's killing my ass.
It's good to know it doesn't go away.
Oh, it doesn't go away. Thank you, Jesus. I'm a Buddhist and I'm thanking Jesus. So look, I'm right now, I may not be able to make it tonight, okay? Yes, I'm fine. Just that Mark
Marin
thinks he's in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He's not. I said, Mark, this is Highland Park, right? I'm thinking it's Highland Park over there in L.A. No, it's Highland Park over near Glendale. Yeah. Well, that's a Highland Park in L.A., you know.
Hancock.
There was Hancock. Oh, okay. All right. Hit me in the face. Hancock Park. Right. Okay. I got it. Now you heard Mark just now. Let me get off because I'm wasting his time. But let me call you back, baby. Okay? Okay. Bye. Go ahead, Mark. Yes. Let's get it on.
Put some cans
that's
on.
Right. That's what happened with me.
I know what happens.
Highland
yeah, you were
Park,
thinking I had
Hancock
a lot,
Park.
You were thinking I had a lot more money than I do.
Huh?
You were thinking I had a lot more money than
you're
I do.
You're faking it. All you got are trust funds. Act like you don't have them.
I got no trust fund. I built this garage from scratch, Mr. Morris.
And it's looking like something from the 60s, ladies and gentlemen.
It does, right?
Yes.
It's bringing you back?
That's right. Look like some naked girl from Woodstock.
Yeah. Looks like a hippie archive.
Right. Some girl from Woodstock who has that wet top on that you wore.
You work today?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Over at Two Broke Girls?
Yes, sir. Look, after renegotiation,
yeah,
they ain't going to be broke, okay? And I love it.
It's going to go on for a while.
They're some of the hardest working, finest looking ladies in the business, but they're hard working. They give you every inch.
You don't quit, man. I mean, you've been working a long time.
I've been lucky, Mark. I've been lucky. Look, I'm in the business where only 20% are working at any given time. So let's first of all say I'm lucky.
You're doing good.
Yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm competing.
Let's go back because like I just talked to Lorne Michaels.
Yes, I know. Oh, my God. May I genuflect? Okay.
I did the best I could.
You know, just like at the name of Jesus, at the name of Lorne. Every knee must bow.
Did it feel that way when you were there?
Hell yeah. Are you lying? Of course, man. I mean, Lauren never pulled that out, but she just understood.
You felt it?
Matter of fact, the more silent you are as a master, the worse it is. It's sort of like my grandmother would never ever spank me.
Right.
My grandfather would whip the hell out of me.
Right.
And even put whelps. My grandmother, you know how she got me?
How?
She looked at me.
Uh-huh.
The look in her eyes
yeah.
was of such total disappointment. You have totally, totally, completely disappointed me. Right? That was, you wanted to just fall to a hole.
That was what Lauren had.
That's Lauren had, right.
Yeah,
right.
I feel yeah. that, and I don't even know him.
So he would look at you and say, cause, and you know, during those times, I admit, I did a lot of stuff that I won't say, I hate to say regret anything. I was in that at the time. It was wrong.
What was wrong?
I'm gonna
Some
say,
drugs?
Drugs, a lot of drugs, a lot yeah. of drugs. I got on cocaine way back then when they called it the white lady.
Yeah, right, when it was still okay to do after dinner.
No, but see, white lady is a nice term.
Sure, man.
Can I say the word?
Yeah.
For a motherfucker that's going to wreck your life, right?
Yeah.
So I found out that the white lady was really hermaphrodite and hermaphrodite.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And she had a long dick. A long one. Right?
Yeah.
She had dick to spare.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, when she walked down the street, she scratched it and got scars on it. That's how long this dick was.
And
right?
the white lady fucked you.
And she
you.
Shoved it up my ass and just kept it there. She said, I feel good here. I'm going to stay here for like 30 years.
Wow, that's a long run.
But hello.
Yeah.
10 years ago, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And although you're not supposed to mention it,
no, I mean,
one thing I hate about Alcoholics Anonymous, the God is alcohol.
Yeah.
As if people on coke and heroin
yeah.
and meth don't get wrecked too.
Oh, sure.
But they run you crazy.
Yeah.
They call you. They badger you. They get your sponsor and the God.
They
you,
did it.
You get rid of the habit just to get rid of them motherfuckers.
Yeah, stop annoying me.
Stop annoying me. I'm going to stop. Okay, I'm stopped. Okay. Right?
I got 16 years. I know the feeling.
I got 10 years as of October 13th.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
You went a long run with the blow, dude.
Oh, 30 years, bro.
That's a long time.
One deviated septum.
Did you get that fixed?
I got it fixed, but still a little weak.
But I remember you when I was a kid from SNL, but the thing is, like, you...
That, ladies and gentlemen, that made me feel real old, okay?
Go ahead, look great.
You
look great.
Much.
But I mean, but you're a little older than me. But you were acting before that.
Yes. I have not. On Saturday Night Live gave me the comedian mantle.
Right.
I was just an actor for 16 years. Matter of fact, I started off as a singer arranged with Harry Belafonte.
So where'd you grow up?
New Orleans, Louisiana. New
really?
Orleans, well, New Orleans, Louisiana, if you live there.
That's New where you were born?
Born in New Orleans, raised in New Orleans and Morgan City, Louisiana. My grandfather was a Baptist minister who had was assistant pastor in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
But my mom was raped, and I found it out when I studied. And when she had me, she was 16.
No kidding.
And my grandfather was, we'll go through his dysfunction, but basically he treated her like fecal matter.
Yeah.
Put her out.
This is the minister.
The minister, right.
Uh-huh.
But they did take me. My grandfather and my grandmother took me, which actually was a great thing.
Because, wow.
Yeah. So I was raised, when he left New Orleans to go and pastor a church in Biloxi and then in Morgan City, I went with him at 4 years of age. So in elementary school, in the wintertime, I was in Morgan City, and then in the summer, I'd go back to New Orleans. So I had the winter for Morgan City, summer for New Orleans. And
you saw your mother, though? Did you have a relationship?
Oh, yeah.
With
I had
her?
A relationship. Oh, yeah. But my mom, you know, let's say if for the first 14 years of your life, your grandmother is the thing,
yeah.
You're calling her, you're relating her like she's
yeah,
your mother.
Yeah, sure.
And I used to really, I realized the difference.
Uh-huh.
So I began to call her what a lot of people use in down there is Madea.
Uh-huh.
Right? And by the way, it is not spelled M-E-D-E-A, as some person has spelled
Madea,
it
right.
in this movie. Okay?
Right, right.
It's M-apostrophe-D-E-A-R, Madea.
We got to correct that guy.
Yeah, it's not Madea.
Yeah, you hear Madea. That, Tyler?
Right, it's
Get
Madea.
Your shit straight.
Right, right. That's right. Get that. My grandfather, despite all the other stuff he did, was yeah. responsible for whatever happened with my brain.
Uh-huh.
Because I now understand from the experts, you got to talk to the child, sing to the
sure.
child, right?
Yeah.
So he had me on his knee at like 2.5, 3, reading the Bible.
Right.
Figured he produced mm-hmm. a well-constructed moral person.
Yeah, maybe
failure
another.
On that one.
Could go either way with
right.
that.
But what he did was, because he read to me yeah. all the time, I was told that at 3.5 years of age, I actually was reading the Bible. Now, Mark, if at 3 and a half I was actually reading the Bible, I didn't know what the fuck I was reading.
Until 10 years ago.
Right, till 10 years ago. Till 10 years ago. But that was my first thing. Then when I was 4 years old, they found out I had this Viennois choir voice. I was singing high tenor.
Right.
So I started singing it.
You were singing in the church choir?
In the gospel quartet.
Oh, yeah.
And on Thursday night, I was in the junior choir. And on Fridays, I was in the senior choir. This was like 6 years of age, 7 years.
So you had that powerful voice.
I was pretty good as a Viennois. However, those Viennois choir boys sound, that's how I sound. Like, I was singing E flat above high C. Okay.
Real high.
Yeah, well, I was singing up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so my first experience was with gospel music. And I also had a very crazy grandfather because way back, I don't know if you know, blues was called evil.
Oh, yeah.
But he had me, his son, listening to Ray Charles and Charles Brown and Louis Jordan in his parsonage, right? So he was a hypocrite.
He liked the blues.
Oh, he loved the blues, right? But he also, I was singing gospel, but he had me listen to Ray Charles and him in his office. So, and also, on Monday nights and Thursday nights, on Monday night you had the Bell Telephone Hour, and on Thursday night you had the Firestone Hour, which was classical music.
Yeah.
So I was really, he was hooking me up to music in general.
So you got to thank him for that?
At an early age, I never even thought of that different. I thought of it only as music, even now.
Yeah.
You know, see, I can listen to, okay, some question, country and western runs me crazy, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm a great lover of Scruggs. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
They're gods.
He's a banjo player, right?
They are gods.
Yeah.
Okay. You never heard anybody play bluegrass like that. So I was into Hank Williams. At an early age. I was also into a guy named Louis Jordan, whom you never heard of.
I have heard of Louis Jordan.
But during the '40s, he ruled.
Yeah.
He ruled. My early experience was like that. So I evolved out of that, and at a certain point I even thought I was gonna be a minister, which of course when I began to deal with theater and entertainment, I in my head knew that I was going to try to be in music and into theater.
Well, yeah, ministry is its own theater and entertainment.
Hello. So I was dealing with that, and I was going back to New Orleans during the summer.
Were you taking in the music there?
Yeah. I used to, there was a couple of clubs, and I was born in Goodtown in New Orleans, right? By the way, the great musician, Alan Toussaint.
Yeah, he passed away.
Yeah, and I found out he was born in Goodtown, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Close by.
Yeah, and he mentioned one of the clubs, talking about the club, he mentioned one of the clubs I used to stare through the window in, the Dewdrop Inn.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
They had the Dewdrop Inn and Joy Tavern in Goodtown.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I used to peep through and just say, damn, one day I want to be an adult and go in there and just do what they're doing. I was, however, a student at Dillard with Ellis Marsalis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when he was then playing the saxophone.
Is he the dad?
Ellis Marsalis is the dad of, obviously, wicked witch produced this man, Ellis Marsalis. He's a genius, and every one of his children are geniuses. Come on. Something happened. You know they talk about Robert Johnson went to the crossroads. Ellis made a deal with the devil somewhere on the Seven Sisters, because every one of his sons is
He made several deals. He had an ongoing relationship.
Right. And when I was a kid, the first time I heard cool jazz and what would be called avant-garde jazz was through the horn, his horn, and to a piano player named Roger Dickerson.
Where was that? That was
at Dillard University. I was a freshman.
Where's Dillard?
That's in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Okay.
It's part of the LCOC.
Yeah.
And he would be there then as a student playing great saxophone, not playing the kind of jazz I heard from Pablo Celestino.
Uh-huh.
I said, Ellis, what is this you're playing, right? And he's already heard Miles and people like that.
Right.
And I'm like, damn, I'm loving this shit, right?
Yeah.
And Roger Dickerson, who, by the way, wrote a symphony that was played by the New Orleans Symphony when he was like, what, in his 20s or something. So these guys, I lost him because at a certain point he was gone. I forgot, people graduated.
But you could tell he was a genius.
I could tell even then. Later on, when I was reunited with him in terms of his fame, he was now playing the piano. And until this day, I still think of him with that horn.
Right. That horn. Like when you were a kid.
Right.
Yeah. But where do you go from Dillard?
Oh, from Dillard, I went to New York.
Yeah.
You want the whole story?
Sure, why not?
Well,
I want to get you to Harry Belafonte when you meet him.
Yeah, in New Orleans, at the end of did it, right?
Yeah.
I had deteriorated into, by the time I was a senior, I was not on the honor roll anymore.
What happened?
I'll get to it. I was on the honor roll for like my freshman year and sophomore year.
Yeah.
Junior year started falling down. And I was being written up in Who's Who in the universities and colleges, which then I lost that. And I lost my scholarship. Because a whole lot of things happened domestically that I don't want anybody to go into, but basically, as blissful and as progressive as my mother's side of the family was, when I got to New Orleans, I had 180 degrees on the other side with my father's family. My father was never on the scene. My grandmother was apparently in a class with that lady who was Sybil's mother.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
May I say it more?
Yeah.
Because basically, I'm going to go through it, but she imparted a whole negative energy in terms of lowering the self-esteem of practically all of her children. And because I was raised by my mom's family and had my self-esteem intact, she couldn't deal with that.
Right.
So by the time I graduated from Dillard, after having told everybody what I want to do is go and be in show business and write, sing, act, whatever, she's saying to me, no, you don't go.
So
you
can't go. Yeah.
She told me what she told all of her kids, mainly, you're my progeny, you owe me.
You're her grandson.
Right, you owe me. Now, I'm 20 years old, right?
Yeah.
And I've already made it clear that I want to write, act, sing. She says, no, you can't do anything with that. You're going to fail at that. You stay here and you teach school. Grandma, I don't have an education thing. I don't care. You owe me. I'm your grandmother. Now, mind you, can I say it? Ladies and gentlemen, I love my grandmother, but she was, in this case, a bitch.
A monster.
Because she hadn't really raised me.
Right.
My mother's family
raised me. Why'd you listen to her?
By then, my grandmother had died.
Yeah.
My my grandfather had married another lady. So basically, that family had disappeared. So I was forced to deal with my father's side of the family in a much more dependent way. And I was a rebel, which by the time I did get ready to go to get my degree and leave, we had a confrontation which involved me coming in to get my clothes. She sits, she's waiting for me. She talks to me first. Now, if you ever seen soap operas, this is where it went. Because my grandmother by now is a master manipulator, and I now know it, right? So I'm 20 years old. She comes in. First of all, she talks very seriously about how I'm being unrealistic. You're not going to, how can you go there? You're not going to study, blah, blah, all of that. Look, Chopin, blah, 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 blah. I just said, then she cries.
And that got you?
No, that didn't.
Okay.
Because she saw neither one got me. You know what she did the next time?
Bap,
boom, pop, pop, pop. This, I'm talking about the South, man, where grandmothers beat the hell out of the kids, okay? Sure enough, she whipped the hell out of me. Right?
No shit.
With her fist. I just ducked my head, took one thing, and when I left, and this is the absolute truth, and I'm only saying because I'm on your kind of a show.
Yeah.
When I left, my grandmother cursed me.
She cursed
my father's mother cursed me and told me I would not succeed.
No shit.
So basically, when I went to New York, I had all that drudgery in me.
She said she cursed you?
She cursed me and said, I curse you, you will not succeed, and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I get up to New York City, and my grandmother had a daughter, my oldest aunt on my father's side, who had also tried to elope and had problems with my grandmother because.
Sure. And where's your father in all this? He's just gone?
Like I said, he was never on
never.
The scene.
All right.
Never on the scene. So when I went to New York, after having had this to my grandmother, I'm going there thinking, my aunt, she was a rebel, she eloped, she's going to hook me up.
Yeah.
Not knowing my grandmother's called her and has dug into that part of my aunt
that still
had that brainwashing.
Yeah,
that's
what
we're talking about. We're talking about brainwashing.
Sure.
We're talking about abusive. That abusive energy was there. Sure enough, my aunt put me out.
To New York, she's like,
so
fuck
first
you.
For the first 5 weeks that I was in New York, I was homeless. And I was sleeping on top of rooftops. I was sleeping in those little drainage things that you have by now. And I had a degree in my little suitcase, right? And I had met a woman because I had been involved in a vocal contest in Philadelphia, where I won second place. And this lady met me then and said, well, if you come to New York, call me. I'll help you out. So I didn't realize, had I gone to that lady right away, I wouldn't have had to have that. But I had so much pride and all that stuff, right?
Swept
plus,
down the street.
Had I just turned and went to the YMCA, I would have gotten help.
Yeah.
All of that. They had all. I wasn't thinking like that.
Yeah.
So I left my brief, my suitcase with this lady because I was too ashamed to tell her I was homeless.
Uh-huh.
She's thinking, he just leave the suitcase and he's going out. He's blah, blah, right? Sure enough, I get arrested twice. The first time, a black cop lets me go.
Yeah.
He finds out I'm from Dillard and all that. He said, but look, man, you can't sleep on top of the rooftop. Okay, they're going to put you to jail, right?
Yeah.
Sure enough, I don't do it well. Like, sure enough, the next time, I'm not putting a racial thing on this, but his white captain finds me, scolds him, and puts handcuffs on me, and I wind up in jail.
Yeah.
All right, so now I'm crying because I know what's going to happen is what my grandmother predicted.
Uh-huh.
She predicted I would fail, and sure enough, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Until on the Monday that I am in the courthouse.
Yeah.
I see something, Mark, I had never seen in my life.
What?
I see a black judge.
Yeah.
I'm thinking this a show or something. This motherfucker can't be the judge. Right? And the white guy said, yes, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor. And the black sergeant, the black, you know, he goes up to him whispering in his ear, right?
Yeah.
And so the judge says, really? I didn't realize that he had whispered to the judge that I was a college graduate, right? Because the guy had seen my
your diploma.
Yeah. The judge said, really? Come up here. He said, you a college graduate?
Yeah.
So I said, yes, sir. His name was Kenneth W. Stamp, by the way.
Yeah.
He said, you a college graduate? I said, yes, sir. He said, what's your, he said, I said, well, he said, where'd you graduate from? I said, Dillard University. Now, he's going to test me because he thinks I'm lying. Oh, he's going to see if I'm lying.
Right.
Because I'm a Buddhist, so I'm not going to say God did it or Jesus did it.
Yeah.
I might say God did it, but not necessarily Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay. Providence had caused him the week before to be in a convention called by Dwight Eisenhower, a convention of black college presidents and lawyers, black lawyers.
Uh-huh.
So he had met my president.
Right.
So he said, you come from Dillard? What's your president name? I said, Albert W. Dent. He said, send that boy to my chambers. Right? And I'm sitting there. Now, I know something has happened.
Yeah.
I'm starting to cry right away because I don't know whether he's going to pack me up and just put a ribbon on it and send me back to the office.
Yeah.
Sure enough, he comes in. He calls the YMCA. And the YMCA, the executive director, says, yeah, we'll let him stay here to get a job. So I stayed. I got a job. And while I'm there, I go downstairs to because then my voice was in top shape, and I still was singing a lot of German Lieder, French art song, Italian art song, all that stuff. And you have to, singing classical music, even if you're on the more lyric side of it, means you're like an athlete. You gotta go three or four times a week to a coach and just have that muscle do it.
Is this opera, or is it just classical?
Classical concert music is more like stuff you hear from Handel's oratorio and stuff like that.
Okay, okay.
It's not the arias.
Yeah.
Maybe some arias, like I sang Dalla Sua Pace on
SNS.
Because it wasn't math project. Now that's a more lyric thing.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway,
See,
there was a gentleman.
You're in top shape, though.
Yeah, there was a gentleman who was with the Belafonte Singers who just come there to rehearse as well. His name was Ned Wright.
Where were you rehearsing?
The YMCA on 135th Street.
Really?
Yeah, the YMCA on 135th Street. So he hears me, and he says to me, well, you know, they're looking for a tenor. The Belafonte Singers are looking for a tenor. Now, the Belafonte Singers are a group that Harry managed and basically sent them out by themselves, and only sometimes he sang with them at the Greek Theater at in New York City or something like that. But they went by themselves. So I went to an audition, and I got the job, right?
And you're like 20.
21, I got the job. So that's how I started off. Now, the first 10 years of my career, basically every half year before like 10 years, I was with Belafonte. But that was like maybe 6 months of you at a job.
Did you have a relationship with him?
No, I can't say that. Some of the other guys did because I was in the third group. So by the time I get there, the older guys have been in the first two groups. Right, who they really related to him on a much more personal level.
But you met him and stuff.
I met him, and he made jokes sometimes, because I'm out of it, but I was definitely an introvert. So the fact that he didn't talk to me was Maybe because I didn't just do what they did.
So he had like a franchise going with these groups.
Yeah. And he disbanded the group whenever it got good, okay? Yeah. Now, that's another story. Because he disbanded the third group right after we won the Folk Singer Award for that year, okay?
You won it?
Yeah, we won the Folk Singer Award for that year, and he disbanded us. But
why?
You have to ask him, you know? I needed that job. So
what 6 months on, 6 months off.
Right. So what happened was that's how I got into the business, and the other 6 months I'd either be doing other stuff or doing off-Broadway plays or I did a couple of Pogan Besses.
Oh, yeah?
A showboat or two, and I was acting off-Broadway when I wasn't with him. So I was building my resume as an actor, just an actor, when I wasn't working with him. By that time, I had already hooked up a couple of plays, one was a thing called The Secret Place.
Yeah.
Lauren came to town looking for a playwright, a writer.
And Lauren Michaels?
Yeah, and one of my friends said, hey, he's looking for a writer, send me a play. So I did, he read it. Basically, it has involved a young man who is the child of a minister, who has a whole lot of, he becomes a cop.
Yeah.
But a whole lot of stuff is in his head that involves the state and the church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more a in and out of surrealism about how that works in the mind of anybody who's dealing with trying to
That's deep shit.
Well, thank you. My ex-wife would disagree.
You were married at the time?
No. I wasn't married at that time, no.
Yeah.
I had been divorced at the
already?
At that time. Already, right.
We didn't get to that part of the story.
We didn't get that part, right.
All right, so he's looking for a playwright.
Right.
But had you done some TV already? Movies or anything?
I had done some movies, a couple of movies. Yeah, I did, first one I did a part was Where's Papa?
With
Carl Reiner.
Was that fun?
Oh, that was a lot of fun. Carl Reiner is great to work with, man.
Yeah, he's a sharp guy.
And he enlarged the part a little bit for me.
Oh, yeah.
And then I did the Anderson tapes with Sidney Lumet.
Oh, yeah.
In which I actually shoot Sean Connery and kill him.
He's a deep guy, that Lumet.
Yeah, he was good director. Christopher Walken was in that.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Do you remember? Did you guys talk and hang out?
A couple times, but my main friend was a guy who's now passed on, Dick Williams, who was a part of the gang that committed the robbery. So it was Christopher Walken, Dick Williams, and I forgot who else was.
Yeah.
The ones that and Sean.
Yeah.
Robbed this building.
Right.
Dick and I were friends anyway, because Dick had a workshop that I worked in, which...
Acting workshop?
Oh, yeah. Dick had an improvisation workshop. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of improv, not like Second City, because Second City was more trying to teach you how to be funny.
Right.
Our improv was more teaching how to be real,
which
meant you can be funny sometimes, you can be dramatic sometimes, as long as you're dealing with the real subject. Mm-hmm. So in Dick's workshops and in Gilbert Moses' workshops... And then Grand Street Hill, in the workshop at that time, if it was a black workshop or a Latin way, it was dealing with more like problems of junkieism, of addiction, drug addiction, teen pregnancy. Mm-hmm.
Social
issues.
Community
and,
issues.
Yeah, and it could become funny.
Sure.
So for me, when I did finally become a part of the Not Ready for Prime Time Players, and they started improvising.
Yeah.
I was at a serious handicap moment.
Oh, yeah.
Because Second City, I was so amazed, particularly at all of them.
Yeah.
But for me, John, and even more so Gilda, just were like effortless. Effortless in getting to the thing that was funny, you know? And there.
Well, how did it happen? So Lauren, he's looking for a playwright, and how do you get in there?
Oh, you want the nasty story, see?
No, not really.
What happened was there were a couple of people who felt I could not write. As a matter of fact, because after about 8 months being there, I realized that although I could write plays in which you had long speeches.
But he hired you.
Right. Yeah. But I wasn't getting down to writing stuff 30 seconds long, a minute long.
At SNL, right.
Except that I did get one idea that came out of the play.
Yeah.
In the play, right?
Secret Place,
there's a point, because it's about a cop who infiltrates this black nationalist group, right? And in that group, we hear the group say, comically, that when they go to fundraisers attended by blacks, they don't get shit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or they get a little bit.
Yeah.
But when they go to a fundraiser attended by whites, particularly guilt-ridden whites,
yeah,
they get loads of money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much they were putting down, but they were glad that these whites had a little bit of guilt.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? So the joke was, this black nationalist group working for a black cause gets his money from white people.
Right.
All right?
And that made it in?
Right. So it almost did for me until the person I told it to told it to somebody else,
uh-huh,
who took it and wrote it as their own.
Uh-huh.
And didn't let me in. Right?
You're not mentioning names?
I'm not going to mention name because you're going to guess it. But this gentleman is a brilliant man. His life now has taken another thing. He's now politically active.
Oh, yeah.
A very important political person.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And was one of the writers for SNL, the original
SNL.
So
you know who it is, right?
So,
He was a brilliant man who I knew at the time,
uh-huh,
was a wrestling chap. I knew that.
Uh-huh.
But I'm so crazy that if you fuck with me,
yeah,
I'm coming at you even if I know you can break my leg.
That's right. He's a stocky little wrestler.
And that day, I was going to do a Scotty Mitchell. You know who Scotty Mitchell was? Scotty Mitchell did?
No.
He knocked out a white producer in 1960-something. Have you ever heard of him since?
Nope.
Hell no. Okay. So
you're going to take him out.
I knew it was going to be rough.
Yeah.
I knew I might win it. He might fuck with me.
Yeah.
But I was so pissed off that the one idea that I got, instead of saying I'll cooperate with you, right, because he had more going, he had more juice about it.
Yeah.
He could have done what he always do, partner in somebody who is less experienced.
Right.
Right? He dealt me like, really, to this day, that particular moment in his life, to me, is not one of his brightest moments.
No.
He's a brilliant man who has a lot of great moments, but that moment was a moment when he simply took advantage of one he thought he could do it to.
Yeah.
Right? So what happened was, I'm a Buddhist, right, who believes...
You were a Buddhist then?
No, I wasn't, but I'm okay now. And I understand, it caused effect. Caused effect because I was still cool about it. I'm going to tell you how serious it was. I wasn't even sweating. I was so serious, I wasn't even nervous. I had made up my mind.
You're going to take that guy down.
I was going to do something to let him know how much I didn't like what he did. Sure enough, I get there and somebody, I forgot who said, Garrett, Lauren wants you in the green room.
Yeah.
So I go to the green room and they're looking at Cooley High. And they come to my part, and I play Mr. Mason, and that's the thing. Lauren says,
"Is a movie you did?"
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And Lauren says, "I want you to audition for the Not Ready for Primetime Players."
But did Lauren know that you and that unspoken guy were at odds, or no?
I remember saying something to him about it. Yes. Yeah. But let's face it.
Yeah.
It's like your word against his word.
Sure, right? But do you think he had you in as some sort of concession? Like, you know, let me
get to the part. Because basically two people didn't want me there, mm-hmm, right? Two people on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
The others were dealing with, hey, keep him here. But some people who were producers were agreeing with the two writers, the head writers. Lorne at that time showed me that he's a guy, you may be a devil, but you're his devil.
Uh-huh.
And when he wants to get rid of you, he'll get rid of you then, uh-huh, right? So basically, that's what his response to them was. So he agreed to hook me up as a Not Ready for Time Bomb player and check me, not have me be a writer, which uh-huh means that year when they won the Emmy, I didn't get one.
Uh-huh.
To this day, yeah, it's something that's in my craw. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Buddha's taking care of it, right?
Huh?
Buddha's taking care of it.
That's right. Right. But here's the thing, is that particular piece about
the black nationalists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That piece came out this way, because I did do it.
Yeah.
Right?
You acted in it.
Yeah, and it was a way of really making it funny and making a point. Because
mm-hmm
in it I say, yeah, I stand here representing 400 years of oppression. You know, you white people, I know you feel guilty about it, where you treated my grandma, my great-grandpa, and my great-grandfather. That's right, my great-grandmother, she was a slave, got raped by her slave master. And my great-grandfather was a slave. Yeah, he too got raped by his slave master. Slave master might have been gay. Anyway, I know you feel guilty. For all of those who feel guilty, don't worry. I come with relief. I'm going to relieve your guilt. Here's how I'm going to relieve your guilt. Send me some money. Okay? Send me some money. Send it to, and I gave the address.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, if you send me before July 4th, I will send you an official documenting a document certifying you as an official certified Negro.
Right.
And that's how it came out.
Yeah.
Right?
That's funny. I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's how that evolved.
And you didn't get the Emmy for writing it.
No, I didn't get the Emmy for writing it.
Damn.
But, you know, that's the way sometimes, that's, you know, I put it down more to that's how show business go. I didn't look upon it as racist.
Right.
But I look upon it as systematically racist.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
The system.
Sure.
But the people there dealing with.
But did you feel that, you know, when you were working in those first few seasons, did you feel isolated? Did you feel like you...
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I
yeah,
did.
Yeah.
But my isolation, I have to blame on my parts as well, because I was definitely an introvert 100%.
Yeah.
I didn't do what you're supposed to do, which is, you know, after the show, you should hang out with the people on the show.
Yeah.
Go to the bar with them.
Even then.
Build a relationship.
That's when that was established.
Right.
When you're the first guy. I haven't talked to any of the originals. You're it, buddy.
Really?
I talked to Lorraine at a live one for like 15 minutes. That's it.
Lorraine Newman.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't talk to Chevy. I didn't talk to Dan. I didn't talk to none of them. I haven't talked. You're it.
Really?
And I've talked to a lot of SNL people, but you're the only one that has been in this garage that was an original primetime player.
Wow, does that put me up on a...
You're like Obama.
Level. Okay. Because I'm about to talk about the level of your taste, but I see what you don't problem. Okay.
All that stuff was established in those first few seasons. You do the show, you go out, you party, you hang out, you meet because it was getting hot, right?
Which I never did.
Just because that's who you are. It wasn't because you didn't like people. You're just a personal, you're introvert.
I am an introvert, and I would go home, yes, and sip a lot of Coke and do a lot of, okay, I'm not trying to sound like I'm some... Flavio Rico and do that, usually menage a trois with a couple of girls.
Yeah.
That's what I did.
That's
not terrible, but it does mean that it's sort of like missing that golf game that you talk about.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. That golf game where the business happened.
Right.
You should build a relationship. You should make sure that you working with have an attitude of positive contributing, that they feel you're contributing.
Yeah.
And you can, if they don't.
Then you're like, that guy's a
you
problem.
You got conspiracies, yeah.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And I realize that's one of my fault. But by the same token, there's a certain lethargy involved in a show that has established a premise that it's not working out. Because I feel that the radical premise it established in 75 should have included, with ease, my being able to be
yourself.
A black thing on every show.
Right.
Right. I had to fight for it.
To be on the show at all.
I had to fight for representational being on the show.
Oh, and not
being stereotyped?
Yeah,
a couple of lines here and there. But finally it started happening with Baseball Been Better,
sure, like sure.
Chico Escuela.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know? But again, I'm not even saying I accept some of the responsibility, but a lot of it had to do with the system and people who simply don't want to fight what they see the system doing.
So you consider yourself being, you know, stereotyped and the token black guy and sort of pigeonholed in roles that were minimized.
Yeah. But mind you, I don't think of myself as a token, but I know that word's being used. Okay.
Uh-huh.
They don't know what was going on behind.
It was
the
being
scenes.
Used a couple years ago.
Right.
With that show.
Right.
They're like, there's not enough black people on there.
Hello. So a lot of bloodletting was being done, but it just wasn't working. You know?
Right.
So a lot of people will say, well, why did you so-and-so? Why did you if they do that, it's going to happen.
Right.
Remind me of the Republicans right now. Excuse me? Those motherfuckers wouldn't do nearly as good as Barack is doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they're saying when they're president, they don't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's the president, and he knows what's coming at him when the real president is there.
Yeah.
Same thing with program.
Mm-hmm.
That people look at it and think that you can actually work out your activist internal feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, I'm practically where Bernie Sanders is in my head, right?
Right.
I'm sure, and you know what I mean, I'm sure Barack is too.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the fact that he realized he could not do that if he was going to get anything done. Now, I disagree. With not having the single payment thing, okay?
Yeah.
I wish it would have worked harder not to have those motherfucking insurance companies in charge of everything, okay? Mm-hmm. On that, conservatives have a good argument. Mm. But still, it is an accomplishment to have it at all.
Right.
Nobody ever did
that
before.
That's right. Yeah, right? Incremental progress.
Right, incremental progress. And so the thing, like, people look at programs, even like the one I'm on now.
Yeah.
I've had people say, well, why don't they run? As if I can go tell 15 writers, hey, goddammit, from now on, you write everything, and every line's got to be one that I get every laugh. And for, you know, why? Because my fans meet me out on the street and say to me, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
No, I'm losing my job, well, first of all. And then what I do, I call that fan and say, lend me some money. He say, Gary, are you crazy? You know what I mean? So you follow the thing of these people out on the street at your peril.
Well, you got to make, yeah, and life is full of compromises. You just got to deal with what you can live with.
Look, I would say this about two people I thoroughly admire, Dr. West and Tavis, who've had me on their program.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really like the real tenor of attacking the integrity, okay, of the president because he doesn't do what I, on the ultra-left side, would like to have. I'd like to have marijuana universally legal.
Mm-hmm.
I would have like to have Medicare. That's it. No, forget the insurance. I'd like to have that.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's there, and I know he wants that, and it hasn't happened. If Cornel West was in there, or Tavis, or me, it wouldn't happen either.
Right.
Because the forces against us, I don't think I can really gauge that unless I'm there. I have no right to say he attack his integrity.
I have some concerns about a Tavis smile, a smiley presidency.
No, I'm not putting Tavis down because I greatly admire the tenor of his show. But I'm just saying, I would not attack President Obama's integrity on that one. Gee whiz, everybody else is doing it from the right
side. So, did you feel like you were getting this? You were getting a lot of this type of feedback when you were on SNL. Did you feel like
I got a lot of that? I got okay. I'll give you a story because I used to look in the jet to see myself.
In the Jet magazine?
Every week Jet would mention black performers.
Right.
The Jeffersons. They never mentioned Garrett Marsh.
Uh-huh.
Never did Jet.
And that was eating at you.
That, look, I'm on TV. Yeah. I'm black.
Yeah.
Right? And all the time, and you know I'm not looking for it with this statement, please nobody call them.
Yeah.
There are a whole lot of things that happened in that Image show.
Uh-huh.
Way back there, I used to go just to look and see. Mind you, I'd already been nationally criticized and lauded for being Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And a whole lot of things issuing from it, I'm sure, affected comedy and stuff. You know, then I'm doing a whole lot of stuff. I've never been invited to one of those shows for anything.
Really?
Never, right? Not that I should have been, but I'm saying there's a way in which which I know there's certain people out there who think because you're black, that's all. No. Black people have a right to have that difference. So there are some black people who look at me really in a way that makes me feel great. The others who look at me really even now as an absolute Uncle Tom, right? Or as someone who, because I didn't perform the way they would have, should be dealt with as anathema. And I would call some names of great programs that are on. One program, they were going to do a re-thing on Saturday Night Live. We're going back.
Okay.
Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And they sent a lady to invite, to do a video, do a recording of me about the show for 45 minutes, right? They don't invite me to be on the show. I'm not going to say who the word was, and please don't perform me because I don't want. And they invite my beautiful lady Jane Curtin and Chevy to actually be on stage with the personage, right? And I'm at LA. I could have paid my own way, right? Yeah. I would have for this person, right? Sure enough, they do nothing at all about me, right? Now, mind you, I absolutely view Eddie Murphy as an unqualified genius who deserves all of the praise for whatever he's done.
Yeah.
I don't see why that means Garrett Morris is anathema to some blacks.
Uh-huh.
I don't understand that.
Yeah.
And there's some really on high levels who feel that way, and this particular person showed it to me because when they did in fact have me, it was when the commercial was coming on and they had about 10 seconds of the 45 minute thing, which tells the world doesn't know it, but I understand that that person is saying, you motherfucker, this is what I think of you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
But when you were there, I mean, working with these people, like, did you get along with, like, John Belushi and Jane and everybody?
Look, let's put it this way. I think John was an extraordinary, ingenious actor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I was on cocaine, and nobody did to my personality.
Mm-hmm.
I never did what he did with cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to grant that a lot of the negative stuff that finally began to happen for he and I came out of that, all right?
Oh, I didn't realize you guys were in, you know, had fights and stuff?
No, it's more like there's a way in which, for whatever reason, he began to deal with me as an enemy.
Yeah.
Okay, at a certain point.
Yeah.
And I never understood why.
Yeah.
Unless it was because of my rantings, which, you know, which everybody, a whole lot of people talk badly about me then. And,
why,
and they should have.
Were we just crazy?
Oh, you know, look, whatever you can think of that people do when they're on cocaine,
yeah.
I did it.
Right? Okay.
So there's some stories that I did not engage in, but I'm allowing my because I did so much other crazy shit. Throw that in there, too.
Oh, really?
Because right? There's one story that's an absolute lie that I
what?
Was actually naked in front of Kirk Douglas, right?
Yeah.
Which I never did. But I'm like, hey, throw that in there, too. Say whatever the hell you want, right? In other words, the belief is that if you can say a guy went crazy on cocaine, then you can lie about him.
Sure.
And he should
did,
not.
Did everything.
Right, did everything.
So how did it ultimately end there? Like, what happened with you and Lorne, or how'd that go?
Well, nothing happened, really. In 5 years, we were all fired, or all
right.
let go. I think a lot of it had to do with what all of us were doing that was dysfunctional.
Mm.
I didn't realize how dysfunctional John's was.
Yeah.
Because it led to what it led to.
Yeah.
I personally don't have a lot of stuff I'm saying about the other people anyway, because first place, I really didn't hang out with them, and it's not a part of me to give up on that. I mean, I'm talking about, if you want to hear about me,
sure.
I'm talking about
me. Do you have relationships with any of them now? And do you ever talk to them? Do you ever run into Shep?
I always answer that like this. I've been in 100 shows, but the only show that people want me to actually have a relationship with is people that Saturday Night Live. No, I haven't, although I wish that Gilda was still around, because Gilda was the kind of lady who she would make you, she would write you.
Yeah.
I love Jane, but I think Jane was in Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, yeah.
Lucky Devil. Although Lorraine is on the West Coast.
Yeah,
again, I hadn't gone out of my introversion, so
sure.
Some of my, I don't know people from my high school.
Sure, no, I know. I know. Obviously people would ask that, but I'm always like, I'll ask anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in but, show business. Like, yeah. How come you guys are in a movie, you're not hanging out? You know?
But Tom Davis and I became a much better friend before
guy.
He passed away.
Yeah, not too long ago.
Yeah,
huh?
Not too long ago. Oh, but that hurt because he was very young, very, very young.
Yeah.
But other than that, no. It's as much my fault as anybody else because, again, you know, you got to reach out a hand.
Well, how did it feel going back for that anniversary show?
That was great. That was fantastic, man.
Was it? Really, and you guys, it was, you know what amazed me?
What?
Not unlike when you just did that bit earlier, is how easily and quickly everyone popped into those old bits.
Oh, yeah.
It was
yeah.
like fucking
right,
yesterday.
Right, right.
I mean, to see Dan do the bass-o-matic?
Yeah,
what
right.
the fuck?
Fuck, ah!
Right?
Yeah, ooh, my God.
It was like time travel, dude.
I
couldn't fucking believe it.
I actually met, not that I'm saying it's a good thing or bad thing, Sarah Palin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it's hard, it's really, and I'm going to say this as a compliment.
Yeah.
You've got to really impart.
Where's this going?
An intellectually dysfunctional aura for me not even to notice that you are really good-looking chick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I put that right?
All right, yeah.
Okay, because she's really a very good-looking chick.
Uh-huh.
But I swear, from all I've seen of her, it took me a moment to say, ugh, get all that other stuff out of the way.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, she is.
All right, so what happened after SNL?
Well, after that, I had a couple of years in which I was, you know, recovering. I went to my, I licked my wound, all about.
Where'd you go?
Well, I was in New York. My wife then, Frida, said, hey, let's go to L.A., you know.
Mm-hmm.
Let's check it out. And at first it was slow because I did a whole about 3 or 4 years of horror films. Excuse me. Yes, I did it for the money.
Mm.
Fuck y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they paid some nice bread for these films that I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I started coming out about in the 90s.
Yeah. You still out of your mind?
Yeah, I still had my mind. I was still doing the cocaine thing.
Yeah.
And it took me, I forgot what it was, but.
Did the Jeffersons?
Yeah, I did the Jeffersons, right.
That's good.
Oh, my God, that was good. Oh, I love those, Sherman and Isabel. And Marla, whom I've done something else with lately. But Sherman was so congenial, so was Isabel. And Michael Moy, uh-huh. who was one of the writers, uh-huh. is one of the guys who got me in, right? And they had a whole 6-episode series
yeah.
with me as their son who had conned him out of money.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then I came back. And
so you got some respect as an actor when you came out here?
Yes, bit. Yeah, yeah. But because of the mantle of comedy uh-huh. that was thrown on me, nobody knew that before that all I did was drama.
Uh-huh.
I had at least about 20 dramatic stuff.
We did Car Wash before. That was before.
Yeah,
SNL.
Car Wash, right. Car Wash, right, right.
That was a hell of a right, movie, right. huh?
One of the things I did with Dramatic Sense then, the thing called Jackpot. Yes, check it out on your Netflix or whatever, Jackpot, starring Garrett Morris and Jonathan Grice.
Uh-huh.
But it's been few and far between. I'm not complaining because I've done Martin, I've done Jamie Foxx.
Ellen Show, you did Ellen Cleghorn.
Ellen Cleghorn, right.
So now you're well employed.
Yes, thank you.
And Morgan Murphy writes.
And Morgan Murphy.
And she hooked us up.
That's right. Who, by the way, you should know that this guy should thank Morgan Murphy because uh-huh. she's a fine-looking, brilliant lady.
Yes, she
who
is.
Who apparently is non-judgmental.
Well, it took a few years.
It took a few years.
It took a little. We worked it out.
You worked it out. Uh-huh. Okay.
Wait, what's the story about you getting shot?
Yeah, I...
You tired of telling that story? Because I know you got shot. I think she
I
told me
say
you
I'm
got
tired
shot.
Of story, but yeah, what? I'm going to get my car done, getting done.
How long ago was this?
1993. I ran the marathon.
Did
that
you?
Was the last year to run the marathon.
On 19- coke?
No.
Okay.
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, 94. No, I wasn't on the action girl. 94 is when I got shot.
Uh-huh.
No more marathons after that. I was getting my car done. His name is Kamadi.
Mm-hmm.
Does your car, man. Mm-hmm. Give him a car. But he was taking care of somebody else when I went to his place. So I said, well, Kamadi, I'm going to get some orange juice. I said, you want some? And he said, no. So I go out. And there's a couple of gangs on either side of the street.
Yeah.
And a couple of them said, hey, Stan, hey, how you doing? So they know me.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't realize that some people don't. Right?
Yeah, right.
And I have on this black jacket that had Africa on the back of it.
Right.
And I'm thinking that this person who jumped me wanted the jacket.
Uh-huh.
But he jumped me wrong because, believe me, at the time, I was 5'6",
yeah.
weighed maybe 155 pounds. Although I am a black belt at the time,
yeah.
in no way am I about to charge into anything,
yeah.
okay? My main thing is to follow Richard Pryor's way. I'm trying to get out of your way through comedy, first of all,
uh-huh.
all right? I'm trying to reason out of your way, right? Uh-huh. And only if you get me in a corner will I be like a cat who, even if a pit bull gets a cat in the corner, before the pit bull kills that cat,
yeah.
he's going through a lot of shit, which after the thing, you'll say, damn, I'm sorry I did that,
yeah.
right? So I'm saying all that to say, had the guy come in front of me with a gun and say, Mr. Morris, hand me your money, hand me that coat. I said, yes, sir, here's my coat, here's my money, sure. my wife's at home, go get that bitch,
yeah.
take my car, uh-huh. everything. No, he came from behind.
Uh-huh.
Now, I hadn't been in a dojo in years. And again, I'm saying, my mentality is not to charge anybody with a gun. You got a gun, my hand's going up.
Right.
Because matter of fact, the first thing Duck Soon Sun, who taught me, taught us, first he starts his class off with, you know a person, bullet. I asked my man, Nigel, I said, Nigel, what's he saying? And Duck Soon repeated, you know a person, bullet. He says, you're not faster than a bullet. right. He starts his caps with that.
Yeah.
Right? So believe me, had the guy come from in front, I would have been told. He comes behind, so I go into my routine right away. So I hadn't been in the dojo. Uh-huh. So I'm embarrassing his ass, right? And I turn around to sidekick him, and the gun is pointing at me, right? And I say, hold on, brother. Pow! And it goes through my arm, into my thing. I get a colostomy I had to wear for like 8 months. I was out for, it ricocheted to my body, knocked out an artery. I was in a coma for like 4 days.
Damn.
I had an arterial restoration.
And you were working at that
right,
time.
Right. I had to have one, my lumbar 5 is missing because the bullet didn't go through. It went into the middle of it, and it was a dumbbell that didn't explode.
Thank God,
so I got
man.
A lot of miracles going on. Yeah. And only because it traveled ricocheting did it lose velocity. Oh. So by the time it hit hard bone, it had lost enough velocity.
Oh, you would have been in a wheelchair.
Through. Right. So I had about a couple of years of a wheelchair, another couple of years of the body cast and everything.
Jesus.
So, and I was told I would not walk or run. I was told I wouldn't run, which they true on that. And I wouldn't walk without assistance. Well, if I get it up about an hour, I can walk without assistance, you know. And to show you how things happen that can lower your self-esteem in one case and raise it in another. You would not believe that getting fired could actually raise your self-esteem, would you?
Uh-uh.
All right. I got fired while I was still in the hospital undergoing 10 major operations. The producers of the show fired me from the show I was in.
What show?
Martin.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the thing that really fucks with me is that Martin went around the world onto talk shows telling people that he went by my bed and cried for me. When in fact, I was sitting on a bed after the second, third major operation and got a script saying about my part, Stan. Stan sells the radio station and moves to China. Now tell me, Mark, does that mean I'm still in the fucking show?
No.
I don't answer, hell no, right? Yet this guy had the nerve to do that and then go around telling people he had done the opposite. And I know it sounds like I'm dropping a dime, but I don't mind dropping it on what I consider to be hypocrisy right in the bullseye of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Okay. Having said that, those people who know him know that brilliant comedian.
Yeah.
Maybe even a genius when it comes to that.
Yeah.
But when it comes to treating people in a certain way, he's also a genius at that too.
Yeah.
But I could never imagine myself having somebody in a hospital who's been in my show
right.
having me do anything else but write to play in a way that fits what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't Stan have been in an accident and still be in the show?
Right.
What happened to me came out of ego. That's what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Okay? Yeah. Came out of somebody who had something against me anyway for whatever reason.
Mm.
I got the chance now, right? Because he was believing that it was drug related, which it wasn't, right?
He didn't know the story.
He didn't know the story and didn't care about the story. Or for that matter, if it had been drug related, what about the guy who's been in your show for 3 fucking years?
Mm-hmm.
What about your allegiance to him?
Mm-hmm.
Wait until you know the fucking real story,
right? Yeah.
He never talked to me. He never said anything to me. Yet, based on whatever he thought, I was fired after 4 major operations. And I'm so a fool with this till when I talk about it, I gotta tell the truth.
So you've recovered.
I recovered, yes.
You're doing all right.
I'm doing fine, yes.
Yeah. You look good.
Well, thank you.
You got all your marbles.
Well, my ex-wife might disagree with that one, but
how many ex-wives?
2.
Uh-huh. You got kids?
No, I don't. I have a whole lot of beautiful nieces and nephews.
Well, that's nice.
I hope they're listening happily, joyfully. They keep me broke, okay?
Uh-huh,
so I don't have kids to put my money on. But I have
and it's sweet, though. You're doing all right. You got
actually, they work for me.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, my machine works very efficiently because of my nieces and nephews.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and did you own a comedy club?
Yes. And for those who may be interested, we are on hold until February. Mm-hmm. L.A. Blues and Comedy. Check it out. We're on hold until February.
What does that mean, on hold?
We're down. The show's closed until February.
And how does that show work? What do you do down there?
Me and a guy named Deacon Jones, who's a great Hammond 3 B3 organist.
Oh, I love it.
We do blues and comedy.
Because
my opinion, blues itself is just somebody.
So, it's a variety show.
A variety show, right. So we do intersperse our blues, our songs, with several comedians.
And what's the venue?
Huh?
Where's it at?
Well, right now we're nowhere.
Oh, okay. All right. So you don't have a home.
We don't have a home right now. Mm-hmm. No.
And when we walked into this, you were in my kitchen, and you saw that drawing of Red Fox.
Oh, Red Fox there. Hey, he was a god to me, man.
Did you know him?
Let me tell you a story, man. One of the most beautiful stories in my life
was
when I went to the safari to see him. Mind you, as a kid, I'd seen him at the Dixie Theater in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And I'd seen him on TV.
Uh-huh.
And I had already had the honor when I was in Saturday Night Live of knowing that he had incurred whether or not I could come do an episode of Sanford and Son. As I'm sitting there listening to him do his show, doing his voice.
Where's the safari?
Safari in Las Vegas.
Okay.
He's doing Gotta Wash Your Ass, right?
Yeah.
The classic.
So, yeah. So I'm going through the whole thing. And my wife at the time, Frida, says, he's talking about you. So I said, no, you ain't talking about me. Then I listened and I realized, he said, this guy came to New Orleans. I said, oh, yeah, right? You know what he does?
What?
Stand up, Garrett Morris. Everybody give Garrett Morris a hand. And he talked for about a minute about me. He said, okay, man, sit down. I see my dressing room. Have swords. And he called the guy's name. Have a Poco or Pepe go take the dressing room. And I'm not going to say what else happened in the dressing room, okay?
He had a good time.
Oh, good time. Had a good time, right? Yeah. Good time. I'll tell you this. He had the finest looking young chick from Ohio. You talk about robbing the cradle.
Yeah. Some pretty good coke, too?
He robbed a womb, okay?
Yeah. Oh, boy. He liked to have fun.
You say pretty good coke? Yeah. I didn't say that.
Yeah.
But
you
look,
didn't say that. I said it.
Look, everybody knew about it. He had the kind of stuff that Keith, who apparently now, he wasn't that way when I saw him at the 40th.
Yeah.
But I guess I can talk about Keith. He talks about himself.
Keith Richards?
When he would come to the show, the good thing about Keith is that he wouldn't have the bad connections I would have.
Yeah, right.
Because mine would be stomped on all the time, right?
Yeah, right.
He would have pure pharmaceutical cocaine, man, that rises up from the fucking bottom. He'd bring it, I say, why is it empty on the bottom? Garrett, that's pharmaceutical cocaine.
Yeah.
Motherfucker. Yeah. And he would just move the whole fucking table, man.
Yeah. Now, that's Keith. I talked to him.
That's Keith.
I talked to him. That's why he's still alive, Garrett.
Yes. And look, you talking about really knocking you out. Because I know what you say about his other life. I regard him as an utter genius.
Who, Keith?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Utter.
Yeah, the best.
I heard across the room on the phone, Garrett, is that you?
Yeah.
Garrett.
Uh-huh. He loved you.
He loved you. Yeah. You know who also knocks me out when I meet him? Who is, I think, one of the most magnanimous guys.
Who?
I know what you're talking about, his acting. I love his acting. Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah.
I saw him on his Broadway show, right?
Yeah.
Now, Dick Cavett is there. Everybody's there, right? I'm not even in the room yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm behind Dick Cavett. He peeps around like that. Ladies and gentlemen, and he starts quoting Cavett saying, the top star tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on in here, Garrett Morris. Yeah. This is Tom fucking Hanks, right?
Yeah.
Now, I know you're saying he's just like everybody. Yes, he is. But you understand, every time I met him.
Nice guy.
He's been a nice guy. You're not even aware of the fact that this is a fucking Academy Award winner who's got billions in the bank or something. I'm sure he deals with everybody that way.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems like a good guy.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you something, man. Your grandma was wrong. You did all right.
Thank you.
Show business has been very, very good to you, Garrett Morris.
Thank you, Mark. Hey, you doing all right, man. In this garage, ladies and gentlemen. Wait, looking cool.
I'm working from home, brother. Yeah,
I know there's some porno mags around here.
Yeah, we'll do that after. I'll give you some porn after.
I want to see some Jenna Jameson and some Vanessa Del Rio.
I could do that right on the computer. Vanessa Del Rio.
Yes,
my God.
Yeah, remember her?
I do remember her. All right, buddy. Thanks,
all
man.
Right, man. Okay. Thank you, Mark.
That was fun.
A lot of fun, man. Let's see, what time is it? Can I go to...
Where, Inglewood?
Yeah. Is this right, 629?
Yeah.
It's on the 629?
Yeah.
I can go to Inglewood.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, it's easy from here, man.
Right.
I'll show you.
Sure is. I'm coming over, baby, if it's all right with you. Okay, I'll be over there, baby. All right. Okay, baby, bye.
She sounds like a nice lady.
She's very nice.
Okay, that was Garrett Morris. I hope you had a good time. I enjoyed that immensely. Go to WTF Pod for all your WTF Pod needs. Let's not get into it too deep. I'm sort of in a time crunch right now. And I need to play guitar, right? Go clean right into the little beast with the black beauty.
Boomer lives!